You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Time to return to the days of yore, when the Wild West hid danger around every corner. It wasn't just the terrain or the dodgy liquor, or even the gunslingers you had to watch out for. For lurking in the shadows were some scary creatures. John Le May returns to discuss a bunch of bygone encounters with werewolves, hellhounds and dogmen across the Americas. We've encounters with a collection of creepy creatures, cursed peasants, witches, and much, much more. But before we saddle up with John, don't forget, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for $4 a month with Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, bonus content, and much more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Thank you to my latest patrons, Simon, Mose, and the marvellous Eerie Edinburgh. And if you haven't checked their YouTube channel out, I'll put a link in it to the show notes for all your ghostly goings-on north of the border. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Mastodon, Instagram, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, updates, and episodes. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by the amazing Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, our silver bullets are packed. There's a sprig of wolfsbane in our pockets, and we ride out in the company of John Le May on the hunt for werewolves. Time to saddle up and head back out on the search for more jaw-dropping encounters in the Wild West with John Le May. His latest trio of books cover a wide variety of weird encounters with skinwalkers, werewolves, vampires and more. It seems that it wasn't just whiskey-fueled gunslingers you had to watch out for back in those days. John, welcome back.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure. As we were joking beforehand, it's always nice when people want to come back. And you said, well, it's nice to know that I wanted you back. But I always take it as a great boon when a previous guest returns and we can have another great conversation.
Well, and I can tell you have a good listener base because my sales boosted right after our last show. So thank you to anyone listening who bought the books last time. I appreciate it.
Clearly, my listenership have great taste, John.
Oh, thank you.
So, obviously, last time we spoke, it was, as I mentioned to you at the time, John, you were somebody I'd been aware of for quite a while with these wonderful stories that you'd been uncovering and your work in this particular field and the way it's kind of developed. And we kind of dove into this beginning of the whole Cowboys and Monsters series of stories that you'd begun to uncover because obviously we discussed that you've got a real love of history, both in some of these stories and the history of films and things like that. So when we were diving into this, you kind of teased us that you were coming down the pipeline with a trilogy based on that particular book that we discussed last time.
Yeah, so the book we talked about last time was Cowboys and Monsters, Vampires, and Werewolves of the Wild West. And, you know, it's basically a collection of old newspaper articles or folklore that are real that I just examine and try to determine best that I can, you know, over 100 years later, you know, how likely is it that these things actually happened? And, you know, what people may not know is these old newspapers from the 1800s and early 1900s, they had stories about UFOs, about Bigfoot, about lake monsters and dinosaurs, and even vampires and werewolves. So it's really quite amazing.
I think it's one of those really surprising aspects of this because I don't know whether it's just my presumption, John, but I would imagine that people just wouldn't expect there to be any stories like this, never mind how many they are, because when I've had the privilege of speaking with Adam Benedict, who I know you've mentioned in some of your previous books that you've done, because Adam's obviously uncovered several stories of a similar nature from the 18th and 19th centuries, which are quite surprising. But I suppose there's this idea that people have, a lot of people, especially outside of the USA, they have this idea of how the Wild West was and what was going on. So when they discover that there's such a rich litany of these stories all over the place, they're very surprised, because it's just not what you would expect to uncover, I surmise.
It's, you know, it's like they say, there's nothing new under the sun. And just like today, how we have fake news. Well, we have a mix of fake news and real news, to where sometimes you don't know what to believe. But back in those days, in the golden age of newspapers, what they would do is throw in made-up stories for entertainment in between the real articles occasionally.
Mm.
And like sometimes they would write these made-up stories kind of tongue-in-cheek, where you could guess, well, this is just satire. But the problem is, you know, when they write articles about Bigfoot back in the 1800s and they correlate with our ideas of Bigfoot today perfectly, you have to say, well, maybe that was a real story.
Mm.
And same with the UFOs and the airships. So there's, I would say, of all the quote-unquote weird stories that we see in the old newspapers, maybe half of them are true, or true at least in the sense that there was a real witness who claimed to see this and what have you. And then maybe half of them are just totally made up by the newspaper writers. So that's one thing I try to be really careful about, because if I try and tell the reader that all of them were real, they'll lose respect for me, because obviously some of them are just way too far out. But I feel, so that's my take, is about half of them are real stories, or at least the witness thinks it happened. Then half of them are just totally made up for entertainment. That's my belief on it.
Mm, I think that's a good starting point, because one of the things that I'm always surprised about is when you look back at this, I remember speaking with David Weatherly, and we were talking about a particular series of articles that appeared towards the end of the 19th century where they were talking about Gorilla Mountain and Gorilla Mine. And people have kind of poo-pooed it and said, oh, well, people will have read about the discovery of gorillas in Africa, and therefore they were just sort of spreading these tall tales. But as me and David were discussing, a lot of people in those days couldn't read, John. So they wouldn't be able to read particular newspapers, and especially if you're in the Midwest or somewhere, I find it very hard to believe that your local paper is going to be carrying articles about gorillas running around.
Yeah, I've found that it takes more contrivance to try and explain away these, you know, cryptid stories than it does to just accept them at face value and say, well, there is a creature living in the woods that for whatever reason we can't catch and we can't find evidence of. But obviously, if everyone sees it over centuries, there has to be something to it. You can't explain it away.
Mm. Yeah, there's always a kernel of truth in a lot of these reports. And I mean, obviously, at the moment, you've got a certain scientific study that's gone around saying, well, I think everybody's misidentifying bears, which is one of those things that I often find. Well, if you specify looking at encounters without looking at any of the supporting evidence, like how close the witnesses are, what the creature allegedly does, how it behaves, it's very easy to give a positive study for the result you want, John, rather than actually looking at the cases. More than just saying, oh, well, they saw something odd, therefore it must be a bear.
Exactly.
When you started these projects, when you started uncovering some of these, and I know we'll probably touch on some of the other ones and what we covered last time, it's amazing to me just how prevalent these stories of vampires and werewolves, and even, as we were joking last time, mummies even turning up in some of these newspaper reports, which, especially the mummies as well, because obviously, at the beginning of the 20th century, most of Europe went Egyptology crazy with the discovery of, finally, of Tutankhamun, especially where everything in the UK in the 1920s, John, seemed to be focused on mummies and pharaohs and curses and strange creatures. So when we were discussing it last time, we were looking at some of these other mummified creatures that were still there that were sort of 40, 50 years before that kind of thing even became popular in a wider sense.
Yes, and just for anyone listening to be clear, I never found any stories of like a mummy coming to life or anything that exciting, but at least, you know, there were stories of cursed mummies, and one of the cursed mummies was the assassin John Wilkes Booth. So allegedly they had his mummy and it was cursed and caused a circus train to derail, and it's too long to get into here, but that's the sort of stuff I have in the mummies book, just interesting cursed mummies.
Yeah. Yes, and it's one of those strange things that, I mean, not just that particular as in Wilkes Booth, but often there was many a criminal who would be mummified for the entertainment of the population, who would come around and pay a few coins to come and see this person brought to justice.
Yes.
Which, I mean, to be fair, there's a lot of strange things that passed for entertainment in those days, John, all over the place, isn't there?
Yeah.
So, were you sort of enticed from that last book? Was it the simple fact that once you had uncovered a few particular stories in certain creatures and cryptids and things like that, that you were then even more surprised at how many you began to stumble on, John? Or did you think, there's so much here, I've got to carry on with this because you've just uncovered so many stories that really needed to be brought out into the modern era, into the reader's availability, really?
Yeah, so the developmental process of Cowboys and Monsters was, I just figured I'd find a smattering, enough stories to just make maybe a 300 to 400 page book. And the economics of book printing, when you get over 400 pages, it doesn't matter your trim size or anything like that, but when you're at 400 pages, it kind of costs more to produce, so you want to keep them, you know, around 350 to 400 max. And I found so many stories for that book, I finally figured out that there was too much for one book. There was really enough for several. But I kind of wanted to finish that book as opposed to just dragging it on and on or taking the time to break it up right away. So what I did is I finished Cowboys and Monsters, and basically I took the best stories that took place more so in the West. You know, they're in Cowboys and Monsters, most of those stories do have kind of a southwestern slant. And there were other stories, though, that I found, like the vampires of Exeter, Rhode Island, the Richmond vampire of 1923, stuff like that that didn't really take place in the West. I kind of set them aside and was like, okay, I'll do something with them later. And so what I did, and it wasn't like my intention to double dip, as they say, when you re-release something. But what I did, though, is I took every single vampire story I found and I put it in a new book called Cowboys and Vampires. Then I did the same with all the werewolf stories, did that in a book called Cowboys and Dogmen. Then I did the same again with all the mummy stories in a book called Mummies of the Americas. But what's cool about these is my cover artist, Jolyon Yates, he designed a mural-type cover that he split into three. So basically, if you buy all three of these books, they make a trilogy that if you lay them out all together, the covers will make a mural that like blends into each other with a vampire, a mummy, and a werewolf. So it's really cool.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. I must admit, I spotted that, John, and I just thought that was a really clever thing to do.
Yeah, so again, it wasn't really like my intention to make people buy the books twice. It was just kind of one of those things that happened, and if I could do it over again, I might do it differently. But I will say this, though. Cowboys and Monsters has some other stuff in it that didn't really fit into either the vampires, the werewolves, or the mummies. Because in Cowboys and Monsters, I have a story about Jack the Ripper and Benson, Arizona that really didn't fit in this new trilogy I did. So if you have Cowboys and Monsters, you're going to have stories in it that are unique. Now, if you do want the book that's just Cowboys and Vampires, it'll have every single vampire story from Cowboys and Monsters in it, and then a bunch of new ones. So I would say it's 60 to 70% new content in Cowboys and Vampires, and then the other 30% is the stuff that was already published in Cowboys and Monsters.
Yeah, but I think it's good to be able to sort of bring back some of the greatest hits, because when you collate them, I think once again, as we were saying then, that just shows how prevalent some of these creatures were all over the place, because as you say, I mean, it's one of those things that often gets overlooked, I think, as you mentioned there. I mean, everything that was going on in the New England area with the vampire flaps.
Oh, there's one, Paul. I know we're going to mostly focus on werewolves, but I just got to talk about this one.
Yeah, go for it.
So there was a vampire epidemic in Mexico in the 1950s. And what happened is there was this rural state called Tlaxcala, where the government noticed these death certificates by the dozens for babies, and the cause of death was always sucked by the witch. And the claim was that these babies were drained of blood in the night and killed by a a shape-shifting witch. And so Mexico actually launched a government investigation into this epidemic. And, you know, of course, their explanation of it is kind of like, I don't want to say of the Scooby-Doo variety, but, you know, they came up with a way to explain it that, well, really, these parents, they were just careless, and they let their children freeze to death in the night, and they blamed it on this folkloric witch. And that's the official explanation. But at the same time, they never really did any autopsies on all of these babies to confirm that they died of cold and not, you know, having their blood suckled.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not really a totally thoroughly investigated case. You know, I would say there's still plenty of evidence of the supernatural in it, but I just thought it was so fascinating that there was a government investigation.
It's strange sometimes when you see that, because it's almost as if they decided they had an explanation for what was going on for this epidemic, John, and then just fitted everything under it just to put it to bed and make everybody calm down.
Yeah, the government is almost always predictable in that they're like a parent that lies to their child. You know, I mean, really, you know, that's like they won't tell them the truth about how babies are made or whatever, you know, because they feel like they can't handle it. That's really the analogy for government and the rest of us.
Absolutely, absolutely. Keep us in the dark until they need us to turn the light on or something.
Yeah.
I mean, you've also got to say as well, John, to kind of dismiss those parents as being idiots and not knowing how to keep a child warm at night seems, I think that's what you would suggest is a hell of a reach, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and a little bit. I guess you couldn't say racist because it's the Mexican government dealing with its native citizens, but they are implying that these rural people are stupid and careless, which is, you know, not very nice. And not really true. I mean, I'm sure that there's probably a few babies that might have died from cold or something, but I mean, I doubt that many of them would have been that careless.
Hmm. I mean, when you say the word epidemic, how many would you be sort of leaning towards as a rough figure, John? How bad was it getting?
I forget the exact number at this point, but there was a whole book written on it by the doctor who investigated it, and it's called Blood-Sucking Witchcraft. I think it's out of print now, but it would tell you, and it has, I've seen it, it has charts and graphs, and it seems like it was up in the hundreds at least, if not more.
Mm. I mean, you'd also suggest, with the greatest of respect, John, if a doctor's writing about it, I think he would know the difference between a child being taken in strange circumstances and one suffering from cold or malnutrition, surely.
Yeah, and he kind of rides the fence on it. It's almost like he won't admit that maybe it really was a witch.
Mm.
You know, so it's one of those things that's, I don't know. But some people, I wish I could remember his name, but they call him the real-life Professor Van Helsing. But anyone who's interested, you know, just Google Blood-Sucking Witchcraft, the book, and you'll get the names and all that.
Mm. It is surprising, especially when it comes to vampires, how these flaps will just appear out of nowhere. And we often look back at these situations, John, and think that these are stories that would only have happened 200-300 years ago in certain parts of the world, and yet I know I've joked there was a big flap here in the UK in the 1970s which saw some very strange things going on in London. And when you tell people about this, and the same with what's happened in Mexico and some of the cases that were going on in New England at the beginning of the 20th century, I think people find it really hard because I don't know what it is. I think the presumption is that, oh well, we're in the modern enlightened era, surely these creatures are nothing but superstition. And yet here we are within 100 years, 50 years ago, that people really thought that vampires are running around still.
Yeah, were you referring to the Highgate vampire thing?
I certainly was.
Wow, I'm so interested in that. Like, I almost would love to, if I had time, I'd love to write a book on that, but I don't. There's too many things going on, but that's fascinating.
It is. I was joking. I was in London for Halloween last year. And we were having a quiet night in on the day before, and there was a big documentary about it all, and I was only four and a half miles away from Highgate at the time, John, so I was I was tempted.
Yeah, I would be too.
So, I mean, one of the other aspects of all this is as we touched on in regards to werewolf stories, and especially these days, there seems to be three camps, I think, John, there's werewolves, there's dogmen, and there's skinwalkers. When you were uncovering these, obviously because you're dealing with a lot of people moving from different regions and different areas, primarily people would always sort of push the skinwalkers into certain tribal nations and indigenous populations and certain beliefs in that thing. Whereas I think these days I've noticed it more, maybe it's because I've got more of an interest in this. Skinwalkers seem to be everywhere, whereas for most people who look back at some of the tribal lore, they're mostly Navajo skinwalker stories, whereas it seems that they're everywhere. And is this something that when you started uncovering these werewolf stories, that you had this distinction back then, or were all these creatures described as werewolves?
So believe it or not, the more you dig into it, really they're all the same. And none of them that I've ever found are like a movie werewolf where they got bit by another werewolf and then they just transform on the full moon.
Mm.
Almost always there's a form of black magic, and what they will typically do is wear the skin of the animal they want to turn into, like be it a bear or a wolf or whatever it is. It really doesn't matter. They just wear the pelt. They usually will use like a magical salve or herbal supplement and then do whatever incantation they have to do to either transform, or maybe they just believe they transform. But I wouldn't say they just believe that they transform, because so many people, like our old friend Linda Godfrey we were talking about earlier, you know, they find witnesses who really saw basically bipedal wolf-like beings that look like anthropomorphized wolves.
Yeah.
So I mean, people do see these things, and they're universal, because the werewolves of Europe, I learned about them through Daniel Cohen's book Werewolves that he kind of wrote for young readers back in like the 1990s, but it's still a great book.
Mm.
And it introduced me to the concept of real werewolves and how different they were from the movie werewolves. And so even the werewolves in Europe, you know, as popularized by Universal Studios and Hammer, you know, they're a lot like the skinwalkers. And again, they just put on the animal pelt and they do the black magic ritual, whatever it is. And then somehow it's like the pelt helps them transform into kind of a half human, half animal.
Mm. I think it's one of those things. It seems to be that films have kind of created in the modern era this idea of how a werewolf is born. But as you say, a lot of it was to do with curses. I mean, I only recently, within sort of the last couple of years, discovered this tradition that if you were born at Christmas, there was a chance that you would grow up to be a werewolf, which is one of those things that I think, is it Curse of the Werewolf? That's the reason he becomes a werewolf, is that he's born on Christmas Day, I think.
Yes, correct.
So it's strange how the old version, as you say, it's curses, black magic, bad luck, upsetting people, being born with the sign, because often sometimes it was classed as being a genetic problem that certain families would be, you know, the seventh son would turn into a werewolf, or you would always be marked for darker things as well. So it's interesting how it's now gone, oh, well, you can only become a werewolf if you've been bit. Whereas when you look at all the old literature from everywhere, and even in the States, it's all to do with curses and bad luck more than anything, isn't it?
Yeah, and also another odd one was if you drank rainwater from a wolf's footprint, you could also turn into a werewolf. But yeah, a lot of them, though, like I've got this one in front of me. It's from, let's see, where is this? I think it's from France in 1521. There was a man named Pierre Bergot,
mm-hmm,
who was out looking for his lost sheep, and he claimed he came along these three mysterious men in black hoods that were riding on black horses, and they magically helped him to find his flock. And like in return, Bergot sold his soul to the devil, and he was given a magic salve that he could rub on his body, and that would turn him into a wolf. And he really was put on trial for that in the, like I said, 16th century France.
Yeah, it is quite surprising as well, because I think, once again, when you look back at that period of time, everybody thinks that people were being burnt at the stake all over the place and sent to death. But the French were really quite forward-thinking in regards to, especially when it came to lycanthropy and people claiming to be transforming into wolves, that they suddenly realised that a lot of these people were sadly suffering from some form of mental illness and weren't doing what they said they were doing, or they were just people who were just assaulting people because they believed that they were some kind of creature, even though they had not physically transformed, John. And I think that's quite surprising that even in those days, 300, 350 years ago, people were already beginning to suspect that there was a lot more to this whole mythos than just people claiming to change into beasts.
Yes, and then there's, of course, the famous Beast of Javadan.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I don't think there was really ever a human component to that, but it was just this big wolf-like predator, you know, in the 1670s, killing all these sheep and people. And why I brought up the Beast of Javadan is in America, we've had some similar incidences. Like in Kentucky in the 1880s, they had something called the Dog Eater.
Mm.
It was this mysterious cryptid that was kind of big and wolf-like, and it would always, for some reason, go after dogs as opposed to livestock, and that's why they called it the Dog Eater. And in at least one instance, it also drained the blood like a vampire.
Mm. I mean, that's something that we still see happening in into the modern era, that there are these stories of certain areas. I think, is it around the Carolinas, where you've had these spates of some kind of crazy creature turning up, John, taking dogs, which I think is one of those things that people presume certain dogs are immune to any kind of predator, other than perhaps you would suggest a bear, really, in the wild. I mean, it obviously depends on which state you are in, because there's obviously all kinds of creatures everywhere, but I know a lot of people will be surprised when they hear about how vicious packs of coyotes can be and wolves and things that, you know, will prey on domestic pets because they see them as easy prey. Whereas you still get these flaps where people claim to see a strange creature turning up that focuses purely on pets.
Yes, and let's backtrack to what you said about the Carolinas, because you've hit on something I can actually remember from a recent book and speak to. You know, because a lot of my books, when we talk about them, I wrote them like a year ago and they're not really fresh in my mind. But when you said the incidents in the Carolinas, so in Bladenboro, yep. North Carolina. So you already know Bladenboro, huh?
Yes. Yes. I'm very aware of that case. Yeah.
Yeah. So that one was cool because they would call it the vampire beast. And again, it would mostly kill dogs. It would drain them of all their blood. And it's very, very similar to the Dog Eater from 1880s Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
Just in more modern times, in this case in the 1950s. So it's interesting because you could read these articles with headlines like Vampire Charges Woman and Vampire Does This. So it was really odd. And, you know, they could never really agree on what this thing looked like. You know, some people thought it was a big feline, you know, like a mountain lion type creature. Other people thought it was a wolf. And because of that, some people even think it was some sort of shapeshift.
Hmm.
And the most interesting incident, the very final one, was about a year after the main attacks, the creature returned, and it was seen in a schoolyard. I think it was the Panthersville schoolyard. And the kids and the teachers, they both corroborated each other's statements. They said that it looked like a wolf with the head of a monkey. And it also had a tail, like either a lion or a monkey, which was pretty unusual.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing, when I read the section covering the Dog Eater, this is the same as what happened at Bladenboro, is that you have these incidents that happen for a specific period of time, John, and then they just seem to stop. And this is the one thing I've never really understood about the normal predator explanation, is that animals will tend to stay where they get food, because why would you work harder than you need to? It's common sense. And these cases are always surprising that, yes, yeah, something may just turn up and think, oh, I've got my own buffet here. Why do I need to move on from here? Because obviously a lot of creatures will move on and have certain routes that they will take, and they can go for hundreds and hundreds of miles, as we've seen with certain mountain lion cases in the modern era in the US. So I'm always as mystified as not just as to why they start, as to why they stop. And the Dog Eater is another one of those where something had seemed to have been happening for a while, and it seemed to have some real momentum. It seemed to be picking up, which often happens as well, John, that these cases seem to get more and more frequent. And And then they either claim that they've killed something that they're not really sure about, or it just stops.
Yeah, why it stops is always the really puzzling thing, because like you just said, why would it stop if there's no body produced and there's ample food there? Now, of course, with most of those, they will claim that, well, we shot it, like with Bladenboro, they shot a mountain lion and said that was the Bladenboro beast, but still the killings continued after that. And again, you know, you really can't explain the monkey-faced kind of dog-lion hybrid that these kids saw at the Panthersville Elementary School.
Mm, yeah. And often, as in with Bladenboro, people were saying, well, that's not what I saw. That's certainly not the creature I saw. And the officials would go, no, you're wrong. No, you're mistaken. You were too scared to understand what you were seeing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes you think, because often that's the same thing, you know, as we were talking about officials and trying to explain things away. It's like the scene in Jaws, John, where all the locals turn up, they all go out and they all start killing every shark. They're going, oh, this is definitely the one. This is the one. This is the one. Just so they just want everybody to calm down and carry on spending money. And it's although everybody might look at that in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, because obviously it's an incredible film, and just presume that that's just done for the cinema. When you dive into these subjects and you see these certain cases, it happens all the time that some random creature will be killed, and they go, yeah, that's the one. It all stops now.
Yeah, I use that analogy quite a bit myself, the Jaws analogy of killing the wrong shark, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not everybody's going to sneak down to the dock and cut them open, though, are they, John? That's the
thing. No.
I was very surprised as well. There's a couple of stories in the werewolf book that really made me chuckle about unwanted love, John, from werewolves who seem to take a shine to certain people.
The story from Detroit, like Bride of the Werewolf.
Yeah.
Is that it? Yeah. And that's a very old folk tale that you've got to wonder what's the truth to it. That one sounds a little more fanciful to me, just because it's like it ends with the werewolf. Like, you think he dives into the lake and a giant catfish eats him or something, but I still had to include it, you know, because it's just old folklore.
Yeah, it's surprising, because there's a couple of stories like that where there's this unrequited love from some canid for a human.
Yeah.
And, I mean, these are some of the stories. I mean, there are many a strange story when it comes to werewolves and living in plain sight as well. I think anybody who knows anything about the history of werewolves in the US will probably, I would suspect that the most famous one is the werewolf of Talbot County.
Well, let's see. I would say it's more Linda Godfrey's one that she discovered, the Beast of Bray Roeder that she popularized. I'd say that's probably the most famous one. And, yeah. So the werewolf woman of Talbot County, though, I always thought it was kind of a funny coincidence that the county was the same name as the character from The Wolfman, Larry Talbot.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That one seemed to be an instance of a woman who was like hallucinating herself to be a werewolf, but she never was a werewolf. And it sounds quite a bit like the movie The Wolfman, where the story focuses on a girl who turns into a werewolf, and it's like her mother who saves her towards the end of the story, which may have actually happened, but I think in the case of that one, it was just a mentally ill woman who thought she transformed into a wolf.
Mm. And that one's got all the elements of a posse going out to look for them and somebody being wounded, and that's what gives it away. It's one of those as well. And the fact that they send her away to Europe and she comes back cured, allegedly.
Yeah, and I always wonder too, you know, is that a story that was made up after The Wolfman? Mm. And I probably knew it when I wrote it, you know, like if me a year ago gave this interview, I'd give you better information and be like, well, I researched it and no, it was a real story from the time period. And I'm just so bad because I can't remember the details exactly.
Hey, that's no problem. Don't worry. I mean, it may be one of those, because I've seen it before. It happens a lot in popular culture, John. There's clearly people who have a real interest in folklore and legends such as this that work in the world of film, because I find it very odd that Larry Talbot is called Larry Talbot if you know about the werewolf woman of Talbot County, because yeah, for me I think it's one of those little winks to people.
Yeah, and if it's not a wink from, let's say, the person who made up the story, you know, assuming it's a made up story. We also have John Keel's theory that we have, he calls them ultra terrestrials or cosmic practical jokers.
Yep.
They're like interdimensional beings that play pranks on us to mess with our reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where these improbable stories sometimes come from. So who knows?
Yeah, I think because sometimes you get these stories and you just shake your head, because even if you've got a love of monsters and cryptids, sometimes you will stumble across reports and behaviours or even creatures that just seem completely out of the box. They're just baffling.
Yeah.
When you were looking in the particular area in regards to, as you were saying, the southern western states, I think one of the things that seems to be really coming back into fashion that people have sort of rediscovered, John, is these stories of devil dogs or hellhounds, which a lot of people tend to focus on European stories about this. I'm very surprised to see how prevalent they are all over the US, but there also seems to be quite a few around the US and Mexican border, which is one of those where you think, well, where are these stories originating from? Which culture had this? Or is it something that's, as you get with certain other creatures, that it's all down to who moved to where and when?
I'm so glad you brought up the hellhounds, because that was one of my favorite things to write about. More specifically, is the fact that Mexico, instead of, oh, they have a hellhound, but they also have like a heavenly hound that is white, that I thought was so cool.
Mm.
And before I go any further, I want to give credit to where I found this. It's from a really awesome podcast / blog called Mexico Unexplained. So if you're interested in Mexico and its supernatural folklore, so much cool stuff there. And that's where I found it. So in Mexico, they call their hellhounds cadejos. And it has something to do, I think the root word is something with the cadejo. It has to do with like a chain that is sometimes wrapped around their neck. I think the root word is the Spanish word for chain or something, and that's where it derives from. But yeah, they have three different types of cadejos. Like one is purely spiritual, like it's kind of like a ghost that is incorporeal that you can't really touch. Then they have a second variety that is like a physically evil incarnated dog that can be shot and killed. And according to the lore, if you kill this dog, it's like the ground will be forever stained where it died and nothing will grow there. And then lastly, they also have a third variety, which is a half-breed of a supernatural cadejo mixed with a real dog. So it's kind of like half dog, half supernatural. And then finally, they also have a white cadejo, which is good, like it's from heaven and it can kill the black cadejos, or it might show up when you're walking along a lonely road and it will walk by your side. The idea is it'll protect you from evil, or if you're lost, it'll lead you back to civilization. So I thought that was really cool.
Mm. Do they have the similar kind of rules that seem to apply to some of them here, that it can only travel to certain places, it can't cross bridges or go over water, John?
I don't think so. So in America, I haven't really gotten enough hellhound stories yet. The only one I really remember is the Hell Dogs of El Dorado Canyon in Nevada, yes, which I think might be folkloric, but I don't care. It's just really cool that we have a place called El Dorado with hellhounds. You know, you can't pass that up.
Well, yeah, that's one of those stories where you think it as we were saying about certain other aspects of the supernatural, there's a kernel of truth in it, because obviously this place was a very lawless, unapologetic, get what you can and get out kind of place, where people were just turning up, mining, shooting each other, fighting over drink and women and gold, and then just running off. And it seems that it's one of those where you had a big gold rush, everything got mined, or as much as they could possibly get to. And a lot of these people had their dogs, and sadly, they either killed them or just left them behind, didn't they?
Yeah, in El Dorado Canyon. And then years later, there were a few campers in the canyon, and they're the ones who claimed that they saw the ghost dogs and they heard their chains. And I thought the chains was interesting, because the chains tie into the cadejos from Mexico. So there's always these correlations with these animals.
Hmm. You often get these stories, like you say, that there are people who see the chains moving, there are people that hear scratching or whimpering and nothing being there. But you've also got some of these encounters where people will be riding on their horses and they claim to have been followed by some kind of strange pack of dogs that always seems to keep pace with them, regardless of how quickly they move on.
Yes, and so that ties me into something else I wanted to bring up. That is, in Europe, and in terms of the skinwalkers, and even in terms of the hellhounds, the werewolves, again, as opposed to some tragic figure who got bitten by a wolf, they're usually witches that are, or warlocks that are willing and complacent in what they're doing. And in New Mexico, a lot of times the hellhounds are really just thought to be a witch out in dog form. And New Mexico has a lot of stories about someone, they'll see either a black dog, an owl, or maybe even some sort of mountain lion, and they'll shoot it. And then the next day, the town witch will show up with, let's say, maybe they'll be missing an eye if they shot it in the eye, or maybe their arm will be bandaged if they shot it, you know, on the foreleg or something. So that's a very classic tale in New Mexico and Mexico, parts of Texas, that you shoot an animal, and the next day a human will appear with a wound in the same spot, and that human is always thought to be a witch. So I think that's kind of an interesting part of werewolf lore that people kind of forget about it because they lump it in more so with witches.
Mm. I mean, there's one story that really made me chuckle, which is called The Vegetarian Werewolf, John, which is about which is about one seen in California, I think, which was spotted gently picking berries and shoots as though it had decided to forego eating meat and had decided to just go for a plant-based diet, which really made me chuckle, because it's quite odd when some of these stories, you know, as we were saying about them being repeated or tall tales, for somebody to create at the end of the 19th century a story about seeing a vegetarian werewolf, I find very odd. Even if it is made up, John, it's a very strange story to create, especially in that day and age.
That's something else that I always say, is if you're going to make up a story for entertainment, I would say you need a beginning and a middle and an end and kind of like a through line. But when they're just really weird and kind of pointless, as in I just saw this weird thing and it was doing this, and there's no really obvious satire in it, like that's the one where I think, well, maybe that was just a real sighting, and that's why it's so weird and unexplainable.
Mm. I know we were touching about where some of these stories originate from. I think the other thing that often gets thrown into this mix is that people will say that the Loup Garou is something completely different as well, John. Whereas I suppose if you really look at it on face value, these are clearly stories of werewolves, but they tend to originate from people from French-speaking regions, don't they?
Yes, you're right. There's more probably from France than anywhere else, and that's also why up around Lake Michigan, where there were a lot of French fur trappers, there were those werewolf stories as well.
Yeah, because obviously you've got werewolf stories that come from Canada too, which once again had a large influx of French people, as we know along the south coast, more so towards the eastern side of the US. Obviously you've still got enormous volumes in regards to the Loup Garou, and this once again it's slightly different, but they all seem to be magic and mysticism rather than the traditional being bit.
Yes, and that's kind of like I was saying, it always kind of comes back to some sort of magic or witchcraft as opposed to a curse.
Mm. Because is it that if there's some kind of time scale with some of these Loup Garou stories, that if somebody spots them, they either pass on the curse or they become cursed for a specific period of time, and they're not allowed to be seen for so many days or so many months or something?
Oh, that's right. I'm glad you brought that up. I had forgotten about that one. Yeah, you're exactly right. Can't remember the precise details, but what flashed into my head with that one that I think listeners will find really cool is one of the ways that you kill a werewolf as opposed to the silver bullet is you have to utter the werewolf's true human name. And a lot of times when you utter their true name, it takes away their power. And that's true of the Loup Garou, and it's also true of the Skinwalker.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So it's weird. You've got the French werewolf, and then you've got the Navajo Skinwalker. And I really don't think the Navajo and the French ever interacted much. You know, there's not really a lot of French fur trappers in the homeland of the Navajo for them to swap notes with. So that's interesting that the given name holds some sort of power that strips the werewolf of its abilities.
There are always little things about this with populations that clearly had no contact. I mean, as we touched on earlier, when you look at stories of Bigfoot or even werewolves, you can't, I mean, we know that the vast majority of tribes would not have had any kind of contact. And I find it very hard that people who lived on tribal lands in New Mexico and Texas would have a similar story to tribes and First Nations people who lived in British Columbia and Washington State and Michigan, John.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's that question of how do people in different locations with no way of communicating with each other have the same stories and they see the same things? And I mean, an anthropologist will probably try to explain it away and say, well, they all descended from a common people with the common legend. But again, you know, you could just say they really are seeing these things and that's why they talk about them.
I was surprised to see a couple of stories in regards to werecats as well, John, which I think when we talk about were creatures, they always get overlooked. And so you begin to think, where do these kind of stories originate from? Because obviously they've got their roots in Europe, as were bears have. I think that when you start to dive into the what can be a were creature, essentially a lot of them are people that transform into a wide variety of creatures, primarily the wolf as being the most well-known and probably the most prevalent. But even so, you would still get people who would claim that they'd seen werecats and werebears, which is it's similar, but it's obviously different enough for people to distinguish that they're not looking at a dog-faced creature, they're seeing a cat or a bear.
That's right, and so the Apache, as opposed to werewolves, they tended to associate bears with the were animal, so that's interesting. And I think skinwalkers of the Navajo could also choose to wear a bear pelt if they wanted and turn into a werebear.
Yeah. Was that one of those that, once again, as we focused on the Loup Garou, does that depend on the mixture, or was that more a tribal lore?
I am not sure about that one. I just don't know.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Once again, you've got two completely different populations from halfway across the world from each other who have very similar stories.
Yep. And actually, Paul, would you repeat that first question again? Because I think I was thinking about something werewolf related. And then, go ahead and repeat it, because maybe I do know the answer. Ask me again.
I'm trying to think now.
You asked something about the skinwalker, I think, and the Loup Garou and tribal law.
Oh, yeah. Is there a similarity that you've got these kind of parallels with the native populations and the indigenous tribes of North America, John, and the immigrants that had moved over from Europe, that these stories seem to run parallel?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the simple truth is just witches throughout the ages, from the beginning of time, have always put on the animal pelt. They've done the incantation and taken whatever herbal supplement, either orally or by rubbing it on their body. I think that has just always been the case. And so it's bled into all the different tribes and different peoples and beliefs.
You know, I mean, when we spoke the first time, I had to admit how shocked I was about the whole witch Navajo ramifications and what happened after the Trail of Tears, John, and the persecutions of people claiming to be consorting with evil spirits and transforming into things. I suppose the more you get into this, because skinwalkers are so tied to one particular tribal nation, have you uncovered anything similar? Because once again, you know, we were talking about vampire flaps in the modern era and people poo-pooing it and thinking it's just old superstitions. And yet, I mean, that happened towards the latter end of the 19th century, which is one of those things that gets overlooked unless you dive into it and look into that particular period of history.
Yeah, so we're referring to, we talked about the Skinwalker Purge of 1878, which occurred in Arizona. It started off with some real witchcraft. You know, basically, chances are the first witch to be executed actually did kill someone and deserved tribal punishment.
Mm.
But then what happened and how it spiraled out of control is people realized, I can get rid of my annoying neighbor or my enemy, or the competitor for this person I like's affections, all I have to do is call them a witch, and they're going to go kill them, and I don't have a problem anymore. So it got, you know, it got out of hand because of that. But see, and I think this is another thing about our society is we like to act as though all of the witches were wrongfully accused.
Mm.
And a lot of them were, but not all of them. Some of them actually were witches that committed ritual sacrifice.
Yeah.
But your original question, though, was kind of more about modern times. And I think, yeah, people do still get accused of being witches amongst Navajo. It's probably not as common as it used to be. But I would say it started to die out kind of around the 1950s.
Mm.
But prior to the 1950s, witchcraft accusations were still pretty high here in New Mexico. And in 1940, a man actually went to trial here in New Mexico, and the charge leveled against him in all seriousness, no joke, and it's in the court records and the papers. The charge leveled against this man was that he turned into a frog and bit his wife. And that was the trial.
He did what?
Yeah, and here's what's really amazing. Everyone who lived in the little mountain village with this man was terrified of him. And this is how you know they were terrified of him. So during the trial, the judge posted $1,000 bail on this witch. And the judge posted it because he thought he couldn't pay it. And to everyone's shock, this man literally pulls out a wad of $100 bills out of his pocket on the spot and starts counting them off till he hits 1,000 so he can walk. And it turned out that he had a racket going on where he would get the villagers to pay him protection money. It was kind of like how the mob does.
Yeah.
You pay the mob not to destroy your business. Well, they would pay him not to hex them. And so he was getting rich off of them, and they really believed he was a witch. You know, he was a witch, but maybe what I'm trying to say is these people really believed he had the ability to shapeshift, and they also believed, again, this is the year 1940, they believed that he had recently turned a man into a donkey as like some sort of punishment or curse.
Yeah. What a strange thing to claim somebody changed into, though, John. You would not, with the greatest respect, if you were thinking of fearsome creatures. Mind you, I suppose if a 6-foot frog comes at you, you're in trouble anyway, aren't you?
Yeah, and that was my thought, too. And I tried really hard to get the specifics of, was he a giant frog? Was he a little frog? What was it? And some people think that the wife and her cousin or sister beat each other up and then blamed it on him is one of the theories that goes around. So who knows?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that, as we were saying about Keel and cosmic tricksters and things, giant frog stories are always a bit peculiar anyway. And obviously the most famous is the whole Loveland frog, which is one of those that's got one of those explanations that doesn't really sit well if you know anything about frogs.
Yeah.
But that's a very strange thing to say somebody's changed into, especially when you think about the traditions and the folklore. If you were going to make up something, you would say, oh, he's turned into a large cat or a werewolf, John, surely,
yeah,
wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I try to rack my brain, why a frog? And the only thing I could think of was, there's talk of like frogs in the Book of Revelation, but I don't think that was it. But who knows? Who knows where they got the frog from?
Mm. I think one of the most surprising chapters is focusing on the legendary folklorist Frank Dobie, John.
Oh, I'm glad you know who that is all the way in England. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Now, Dobie is a man who wrote extensively, one of those wonderful people that has went out of his way to kind of collate as much local stories and legends and myths to keep them into the modern era. And I think it's something that really seemed to drop off a lot after sort of the latter part of the 20th century. And I think now in this era of social media and self-publishing, a lot of it seems to be coming back to the front of people's minds, John, which is a brilliant thing, really, because some of these stories, as we're talking, I mean, imagine never knowing about a man that changed into a frog and bit his wife and going to court. It's fascinating for me when I look at regions around the world and they've got such a rich history of wonderful stories. Wherever you look, if you look hard enough these days, you can find something that will amaze and astound you. Dobie was one of those people that clearly had a real passion for folklore and legend and went out of his way to try and collect as much as possible, isn't he?
Oh yeah, I love Dobie. Dobie even inspired me to write a novel that's kind of woven together through the different folklore of the Southwest that I might briefly mention later because it has a skinwalker in it. But the story about Dobie and the not exactly a skinwalker, So there's a story in Cowboys and Dogmen about Dobie. It's about a witch that turns into a cryptid, as interesting as that sounds, because Mexico has a cryptid cat called the Anza, which is just this unclassifiable big mountain lion that nobody can ever catch, but different people see. But basically the story is that Dobie and his hunting partner, they actually shot and killed an Anza, and they run across this tribe of native people just walking through the desert, and they see the mountain lion, and they point out how it's missing some of its toes, and they tell him, well, that's because there was a witch in our village and we cut off some of her fingers, and that must have been the witch in her animal form that you just killed. But it turns out, though, Dobie just integrated himself into that story. So I'm not going to say it's not true. I think Dobie just heard this folktale, and then he decided to integrate himself into it to make it a little more interesting to his readers. So that story kind of taught me to be a little bit weary of Dobie as far as the facts go sometimes.
Well, I suppose it's one of those that if you find a story that's so interesting, often, as we were saying about people looking down their noses at certain people from their backgrounds, Jono, or their upbringings or their education or their rurality in regards to not living in the city and therefore not being civilized or whatever.
Yeah.
Then obviously I think Dobie was one of those people who had a real passion for it. And I think he would just expect people to be disinterested unless he could kind of bring it front and center and say, I know this has happened because it was me.
Yeah. And that was, of course, the days before the internet when you could Google these things and really research stuff.
Yeah.
Back then that wasn't an option.
When you look into Dogmen and Werewolves, are you surprised? Because I think with Linda Godfrey's body of work, bringing the Beast of Bray Road into the modern era from when that started, I think as with that, everybody kind of thought, oh, well, everything started in Bray Road at the beginning of the 90s. And once again, it's one of those that once you open that box, you realise that people had been reporting things like that for at least 100 years, John. It wasn't just a modern interpretation. And because once again, as we were talking about the internet and Googling things, when the Bray Road flap started, these people would have had, it's not like they'd read a story on the internet and gone, oh, well, I'm going to pretend to have seen that. There would have been no way for people to create a creature like a dogman or a werewolf to be running around this particular area of the US from nowhere. You have to think, once again, we're talking about creatures appearing from nowhere and then disappearing again. Why did it just start at the beginning of the 90s? And you can see that happens in a lot of these stories about these strange creatures, especially when you're talking 100 years ago. Something just happens and it all goes mad for a bit.
Yeah, it's hard to define and quantify. It's just that's why I kind of gravitate towards John Keel's ultra-terrestrial thing with these cosmic practical jokers that make no sense, and they're just kind of here to confuse us.
Well, it makes as much sense as any other explanation, John, if nothing else. I suppose when you're diving into this, as we've shown, you've created this marvelous trilogy focusing on them. Are you still uncovering new stories that you've thought, oh, I'm just going to have to do something else here? Because did you, with your love of history and archival research, know what you were letting yourself into when you discovered those first few stories?
No, and I mean, again, it really dates back to 2011 when that movie Cowboys and Aliens was coming out, and Noe Torres and I just decided, well, there's all these old accounts of UFOs in the Old West, let's do a book. And with the advent of like newspapers.com and newspaper archives where all these things are digitized and you can search them, it just opened the floodgates for stories about dinosaurs and werewolves and all these things in the Old West that you didn't think existed back then. You thought they were just movie creation.
I mean, the dinosaurs one's always really intrigued me, because once again, as we were talking about mummies in Egypt and all that, dinosaurs are one of those things that these days I think people just presume we've always known about them, but 200 years ago nobody had the first idea what a dinosaur was.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you think this is similar to some of these stories that we get out of Australia? So I know you've done some research in regards to strange creatures wandering around the outback out there, John. And these stories of these giant creatures running amok or running all over the place in Australia have been around for a very long time. Once again, we're talking 40, 50, 60 years. People were reporting stumbling across giant lizards in the middle of nowhere out there.
Yeah, so I did do a book finally on, because it kind of matched the cowboys and dinosaurs theme, because Australia has a big cattle industry and cowboys that they call jackaroos and stuff.
Mm.
So I did a book called Cowboys and Saurians, Dinosaurs Down Under, which talks about Burunjor, which is this T-Rex that allegedly like raids the cattle pens and kills livestock. But I will say, though, if you're really interested in dinosaurs in Australia, don't buy my book. My book's just kind of like a gateway into the whole thing. If you're really into that, buy the books of Rex Gilroy, who's the, I believe, the premier Australian cryptozoologist. And he has these really thorough books on Burunjor and just different Australian cryptids that are really neat. So those are really make for fascinating reads.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about that area of the Pacific where there's some, wherever you go, there's islands all over. And obviously, of course, you've got the stories of the Komodo dragon, John, which people used to dismiss as a tall tale until one tried eating somebody.
Yeah.
And then they went, oh, hang on a minute, there's a 9-foot lizard here that likes to eat people. and you still see horrific stories these days of what Komodo dragons will do if given the chance. And as with most predators, they will usually go after smaller prey. Children, unfortunately, but I've seen interviews with people who have been asleep and been woken up in the middle of the night by something munching on their toes.
Yeah.
Which is never a nice feeling, John.
Yeah.
So, as you've alluded to, you've been working on a book diving more into the werewolf yourself, haven't you?
So yeah, I was referring to I did a novel finally. But so I you know, a lot of people feel like they're wasting their time if they read a novel because it's purely fiction. And there was a New Mexico author who had a lot of success named Tony Hillerman,
mm-hmm.
who what he would do is he would weave real facts about the Navajo Nation into his murder mysteries involving these two Navajo police officers named Jim Chi and Joe Leaphorn. And they became very popular because people knew they could learn as they read. They would get some real history about New Mexico and the Navajo when they read these mystery novels. So this was also my goal. I wrote a book called Once Upon a Time in Fort Sumner. And the villain of the book is a skinwalker who wants revenge for the atrocities of the Long Walk.
Mm.
And so when you read the book, it is fictional, but you'll get a lot of real history about the Long Walk, about Billy the Kid, about how skinwalkers work. Like something I used is to become a skinwalker. This is true according to tribal lore. To become a skinwalker, you have to kill your sibling, or if not your sibling, a close family relation, and somehow that's what gives you the powers.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think to kill a skinwalker, you either need to have like a bullet or a knife that's dipped in white ash,
mm.
and I use that, or you have to use the skinwalker's real name. And so, you know, so if you read the novel, it's a fun little murder mystery adventure story, but you will learn real facts about New Mexico and skinwalkers, and Billy the Kid figures into it as well. So,
mm. So is that a case of building a historical framework and then fitting your supernatural narrative through it, John, as you refer to? You're talking about the Long Walk and Fort Sumter and Billy the Kid. So these are sort of tent poles that people are very aware of. These are historical characters and incidents that occurred. So do you find it easier to sort of set up these bridging points that have happened and then weave your story around them?
Yes, exactly. And the backbone of the whole series, because there's going to be more of them, the backbone is the Hero Twins. And the Hero Twins are common to both North and South America. All the indigenous peoples have legends of these two twins who they call them the Hero Twins, but they also call them the Monster Killers. And it's like their job to kill the monsters or the giants or whatever that inhabit the land. So the books are essentially about the modern version of the Hero Twins, which in this case, you know, they have to fight a skinwalker in this book, which, again, if you're interested, it's called Once Upon a Time in Fort Sumner.
Fabulous. Fabulous. So clearly, as you were referring to, that gave you an appetite to continue the series then, Joe.
I plan to do a lot of them. And in that same vein, I got made a co-host on this podcast. So here's the name. It's called Plot Pit. You know, PLOTPIT, Plot Pit. And what we do, the creator, his name is William Atkinson.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this really neat idea where what we do is we take about three real stories. It can be real newspaper articles. It can be real folklore, real events. But basically the goal is to find three unrelated true stories. And then in real time, in about 20 minutes, we will craft like a movie or book outline out of these story elements. And on one of the episodes, what we actually did is we used the trilogy we've been talking about on this episode. So it was myself, William, and another author named Beverly Coots. And each of us had a book. I had Cowboys and Dogmen. Beverly had Mummies of the Americas. And William had Cowboys and Vampires. And we said, okay, we're all going to pick a random story from each of these books. And we can't corroborate with each other. We just have to pick the story. And then live on air, we're going to form a story out of these three that we've collected. And I picked one about a werewolf in Canada that gets killed with a golden bullet in the 1880s. Beverly picks the chapter on the Spiro Mounds of Oklahoma,
yeah,
of like the 1920s, which is basically where they found these Mesoamerican remains in Oklahoma that kind of had ghosts and curse revolving around them. Then William picked a story about a vampire skeleton discovered in like the 1890s. And so again, our challenge was, okay, in 20 minutes we have to make a working story out of this. So what we did is we decided that the guy from Canada who killed the werewolf with the golden bullet in the 1880s, he becomes a monster hunter. And he's got to find these cursed bones. And you know, so you've got the cursed vampire skeleton from Nevada, and then you've got all the cursed bones from Spiro Mounds. And the story as we evolved it live on air was that, okay, so it turns out that this monster hunter, he's gone bad, and he actually wants to conjoin these evil bones to get these special powers. And so then the monster hunter's younger apprentice has to become the hero and take down their mentor. And the story just kind of wrote itself, like I said, in real time in about 20 minutes. So if you like stories, but you also like to learn real history, Plot Pit is kind of interesting in that regard. And like last week we did the green comet that recently passed over Earth, and we conjoined it with the green fireball wave of the 1940s and also the lore of the green man and made a story out of that.
So you certainly have to have your wits about you, John.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's a fun challenge,
yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose with someone who loves cinema as much as you do, and especially some of the weird and wonderful monster films that have been released over the years, I suppose it's rich pickings for someone with such an interest in that.
Yeah, and like another episode, I have my friend Neil Reby on. Neil writes dinosaur novels. So for Neil, we just took the famous Tombstone pterodactyl story of 1890, and we didn't add anything to that one in terms of other stories. We just took that one story and decided, okay, we're going to make a 1950s monster movie based off of the Tombstone Thunderbird as a jumping off point. So that was another really fun one that turned out extremely well.
I think I'm surprised. The more I speak to you, John, the more prolific you seem to be getting. And I know you've got several projects coming up. I know you're looking at doing a wonderful book about witchcraft. So how did you come to that? Was that once again uncovering these stories during the research for some of the previous books you've done, or is that something you've always had an interest in?
Yes. So, you know, I live in New Mexico, which has, out of all of the states in North America, has a pretty steep history in witchcraft, especially in the colonial era. And part of it was I planned to use the witchcraft mythos and, you know, the series of novels I'm doing on the hero twins. But the real stories were just so interesting. I wanted to write about them just in their real historical context. So hopefully that'll be out by this summer.
I suppose, is that one of those wells that you're amazed how deep these stories go, and it's something that's still going on to this modern era?
Yes, because initially with the book on the history of the witches, I envisioned it as a small little book, maybe for the history press, because they like short little 120-page books for the tourists to pick up. And I started with that in mind, and as I got into it, I was like, no, I can't do this. It's got to be a really thick scholarly book with all these footnotes and every story I can find. So now it's getting pretty big, and it's not – I couldn't even pitch it to the History Press anymore because they like smaller books. So it'll be another one I probably just self-publish.
So have you got any other projects keeping you busy? Because I'm amazed you've got as many hours in the day to do everything you're doing, John.
Oh, well, yeah, and sometimes I have to admit, so I start these projects because if you don't start them when they're fresh in your mind, you're going to forget about them or you'll lose the inspiration.
Mm.
But the problem is once I start them, they're like these little strings just pulling at me, and I want to finish them. Like right now, what I'm trying to finish is a book on unproduced dinosaur movies of the 1960s and 1970s, and then on the other end, I've got the New Mexico witch book that's still unfinished. Then I'm writing a novel about Billy the Kid. So at some point I need to take a break or just focus on one thing and not go back and forth between so many.
Well, I'm glad you're keeping busy, and I will always be entertained and look forward to anything you've got coming up, John.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and the newest book I think that would interest you and your listeners is Cowboys and Saurians in the Modern Era, which covers things like the Texas pterodactyl of 1976. It covers the Bladenboro beast, just kind of more modern cryptid stories, but kind of still with that cowboys and saurians feel to it, you know, and that they were maybe taking place in rural areas and, you know, stuff like that.
Mm. I think that's the surprise when we still get these reports of people seeing, especially when it comes to pteranodons and large flying reptiles all over the certain parts of the US, John, that people seem that once again, they seem to just poo-poo it as misidentification. But I think often these people are very aware of the creatures that should be there. It's the fact that these creatures shouldn't be there that's what surprises them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even with the Texas pterodactyl, the more I researched that one, it also had just a few little traces of kind of witchcraft adjacent stories that I learned from New Mexico. Because, you know, one of the so-called pterodactyls had like a bat-like face, and it attacked a man outside of his home late at night. And it just really sounded like something that if it had been reported back in the 1770s, as opposed to the 1970s, they wouldn't have said it's a dinosaur. They would have said, oh, it was a witch out flying and it attacked me. So that's kind of interesting as well.
Mm, brilliant. So where can everybody get hold of your work, John, follow you online and keep up to date with what's going on?
I finally started a website. It's bicepbooks.com. So if you go on there, it's got all of my books that I talk about on here. And, you know, you just click on them and it'll take you to their Amazon page. But it's, you know, but it's got all of my books in a nice orderly fashion that way. Or just type in John LeMay on Amazon.com and, you know, you'll eventually find my author page. And it's a little overwhelming because my author page has a fanzine on it that I published, and the fanzine has a lot of issues.
Yes.
So it will say that I've published 111 books. I haven't. I've published like 40, but if you go on my Amazon author page, it'll say something like over 100 books, but it's really just issues of the fanzine and stuff like that.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything as always in the show notes. And John, thank you for coming back. It's been lovely to catch up with you and dive into some of these strange stories involving werewolves from around the Americas.
Thank you. Maybe another 6 months or so I can come back again. I'm always happy to talk to you.
Absolutely. We'll have to chew over. Maybe we could get our teeth into vampires, pardon.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds good to me.
Well, listen, thank you as always. You take care. It's been lovely to catch up with you, and we will speak again. Look after yourself and stay safe.
Thank you, Paul.